Thank you very much. All right. So I want to just introduce Joe to you. So I'm very, very pleased to introduce Joe. Just to say a little bit about Joe Shapcott. So Joe won the Commonwealth Poetry Prize for the best first collection. She's won the Forward Poetry Prize and the National Poetry Prize twice. She's edited an anthology of contemporary poetry with the poet Mathew Sweeney called Emergency Kit, Poems for Strange Times, and has published versions of Rilke's French poems. She is a professor of poetry at the Holloway at the University of London and is the president of the Poetry Society. Her most recent book of poems, Of Mutability, you have it in the bookshop, was published by Faber and Faber in 2010 and was shortlisted for the Forward Prize and recently won the prestigious Costa Book of the Year Award. Sean O'Brien from the Sunday Times says, Shapcott is gifted and original, and it is in works such as hers that the future health of poetry needs to be sought. Joe Shapcott. So welcome, Joe. Very nice to see you.
Thank you. Thank you for that lovely welcome and introduction. Good. No pressure then.
It's all quite straightforward. So we always start by asking our guests why they chose the poems they did. First, just sort of say a little bit about your choice of Dickinson.
I've since I can remember, I've always loved Emily Dickinson, and I think. The thing that I respond to very powerfully is her image making. And it reminds me more than anything else of music, the way you don't question music, you don't ask for a meaning, you just love the patterning and it bypasses those questioning bits in your brain. Mm. And I feel her image making does that. So when she says something like, there's a certain slant of light, winter afternoons, that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. You don't question it, you don't ask what it means, it sort of bypasses everywhere and goes straight to your understanding, your deeper understanding. Mm. And in that particular poem, I love its audacity because she's describing the moment of death of her own death, as if before and afterwards, as if she's standing outside herself. Mm. And the materiality of the world, even an idea of what she calls, I think, the king, become less important than this interposing little fly, which is somehow, again, you don't know why, you don't even ask why, is very moving.
Mm. There's also something slightly terrifying about her poems, I always think.
Yes.
Does that attract you as well?
I don't know if the terrifyingness attracts me, but I do think it's bold, it's important, it's an enormous subject. Mm. But she has a very intimate touch. So I heard a fly, and matter of factness, I heard a fly buzz when I died, as if she was talking about the washing up, which again speaks to us very immediately. It could be something you or I had said to each other, not a sort of 19th century American lady. It's completely with us now.
Yes, indeed. And I was delighted you chose Elizabeth Bishop. She's a hero of mine. I keep on telling people to read her. It's amazing how few people have actually even now heard of Bishop. And I know she's influenced your own work, and I know you've written a book of essays, or co-edited a book of essays about Bishop's work. I wonder whether you might just introduce her to... Some of the people here will be completely new to poetry generally, but just you might introduce her a little bit. And
she's an American poet who... died in the 1970s and was a contemporary of Robert Lowell. Born in Nova Scotia, she travelled a lot. She was a kind of poet of exile. And I think that's one reason I responded to her well, because certainly when I was at school, there was a suggestion that the poets of the countryside were the thing to be. And if you lived in the countryside, you therefore had it made, and that you could therefore be a poet. Whereas I was a city girl, and you know, I didn't feel a particular affinity to the place where I lived or grew up, which was all new. So her idea that you can travel and still be a poet, that you can listen to lots of types of English and still be a poet, was quite exciting. So as an example, I think. But then also in the poetry itself, again, the conversational tone, which hides so much kind of urgency, in Crusoe in England, which we had the extracts from, at the end, when she talks about the knife, which on the island would have been so important, it would have been a matter of life or death to keep that knife sharp and working, but then lost all its meaning. It reeked of meaning like a crucifix, and now all that had drained away. And it always reminds me of what we try to make happen in our poems. We try to make things reek of meaning. Too often, in my case anyway, the meaning's drained away. But you know what I mean? And that's an idea I loved, and it seems to apply to language, and the language of poetry as well.
And she seems to have been important to you personally, you were sort of mentioning that, but because she's partly a poet of exile, she also likes talking different voices, doesn't she, like Crusoe in England?
Yes. Although not so much with her. She has a kind of this wonderful, easy conversational tone and an interesting use of I, which is very sparing. She actually wrote in a letter once that it kind of hurt her to use the pronoun I too much. She couldn't imagine doing it. She had a kind of almost formal reticence with that pronoun, a sense of manners or something. And I'm not like that. I splurge out all over the place, though they're not always me. I think voices, I don't know where voices came from. I think probably other examples of other writers too.
Yeah. Marianne Moore, for instance, perhaps?
Yeah, no, Marianne Moore is another poet I like very much.
So I want to move a little bit onto you, a bit more on your life. So obviously one of the things I'm always interested in is, when did poetry enter your life? You know, when did you start? Did it enter with in a big way? Did it? I know you were a very voracious reader when you were younger, for instance, but can you say a little bit about how poetry entered your life?
I don't really know. I did read a lot, and I feel very deeply about the libraries, because we didn't have many books in our house. But one thing I did with my dad was go to the library every Saturday, and it was the thing we did together. And I worked my way through first the kids' library and then most of the way through the adult library. And there were very good librarians to help in those days too. So that was, you know, it's why there are a million people on the streets today. That was really important. And to think that there are kids and young people who won't have that now is, you know, terrible.
You mentioned your father, and I'm aware from interviews that your parents both died quite suddenly and within a few months of each other when you were about 18, and then and there's a rather indelicate question. I've got a few indelicate questions to ask. I'll tell you when they are.
Okay.
We have an indelicate light. That kind of right. So this is indelicate question number one. I'll come under. Anyway, never mind. So I was just sort of wondering how did that affect you? Did that change? Again, I'm thinking of this poetry of exile, but also, what is the effect of that? How did that change your perspective on life? Did it change it? It must have done.
My mum and dad were amazing people, and all I can really say about it is that their lives and their deaths made me who I am. But can I say a little other thing about that? Because we were talking earlier, and I was saying there's an essay in my head which I really want to write that I haven't written yet, which will be called Against Autobiography. And because
you can see why this is making me look
pretty. Because now it's important. It's a really interesting discussion, I think. Because I so feel that it's the poems that are interesting. And I'm not an autobiographical poet, or very rarely, you know. So it's not as if what's the events of my life are very important for the poems or for anyone. It's a very ordinary, dull little life. Thank heavens. So, you know, I just feel we're in a kind of time where there's a real, almost prurient hunger for reality, you know, and the idea that you might make things up, that you might sit around the fire and tell stories about things that aren't real, but are not no less important for that, perhaps more important. We've sort of lost that, so non-fiction sells more than fiction. And you know, if you don't have a kind of a good personal story, you won't sell a book. And I, you know, I just, that upsets me. You know, it really does. I think it's the work, it's our action, it's not the self. It's unimportant. It's the manifestation, it's the, you know, it's that stuff out there.
Well, that's our page, shall we? So, for instance, in what I'm looking at, in one interview, for instance, you do say that I'm not interested in self-revelation.
Yes, that's right. Because it is to do with this idea that. It's a sort of cult of personality that we have now, isn't it? And celebrity and all of that. So every celebrity has written a book about themselves, you know, by the time they're about 20. I just think there's a division that's quite important between this, you know, me and going about and being very unimportant and the work. And, you know, the other thing I think about it is probably... if people were to study my life, they would be terribly disappointed. I wouldn't live up to it. But I hope my work is my best self. So I'm very happy, you know, to put that out there. And that's all that I can ask of myself. You know.
So is it a concern of kind of to do with faction? Because I know someone, for instance, is very concerned about the idea of faction. That he thinks that it's getting more and more blurred between what is fiction and what is truth, and we're learning our history from... films that are only loosely based on the truth. Is it that kind of concern as well? Or?
That I mind less. I don't mind a kind of playfulness about reality and events. That's quite interesting, and I think, you know, everyone here will be quite a good reader of that. And I think all of you here who are poets will also know that, you know, you write stuff in the notebook. Some of it might relate to things that have happened. A lot of it won't. Some you'll have overheard, some will be in the newspaper, some you'll have read. Occasionally there'll be bits about things that have happened. In the end, it becomes a kind of... that's the material that becomes the poem. And no one source, but many sources. And so things... and it's actually the mutation that's the wonderful thing. The way things move. As in the Bishop poems, I mean, the quality of that observation that looks at that knife and makes it reek of meaning also, you know, leads to a kind of epiphany. So this very conversational tone suddenly lifts, and there's always in one of her poems that kind of moment. Plug on.
I will. So I do want to ask you some personal questions. I was struck by the fact that you went to Harvard for 2 years and you were studying with Heaney, you know, the poet I very, very much admire. Really feel that when one reads Heaney, one is reading someone with real depth and generosity. So I'd just be interested to hear what it was like for you at Harvard, how that affected you, your voice as a poet, how Heaney's influence affected you. Because I don't see Heaney in your work.
No, although he was a poet I was introduced to quite young at school,
was
and
admired,
always
yeah.
admired. And he was wonderful to be in his class, really. And he is, you know, everything you might imagine he is. He's very open and generous. So that was a real privilege. He taught me a lot. But I think you're probably right, the voice isn't there, but there's a lot of things that he taught me are there.
Well, one of the things I perhaps do see a bit is his formal rigour feels very much, it seems to me, reading the poems, something that's of real concern to you is that sort of a formal rigour.
Yes.
Which doesn't feel quite right to the actual tone of the poem, but that's what I can see anyway.
No, I think that's right. I'm a bit of a kind of train spotter about form and bore on about it for ages, but I am very interested in form and versification, traditional form too, though I don't use it much, but I use aspects of it, I suppose. But also at Harvard, not only Heaney, I had another rather extraordinary teacher called Robert Fitzgerald, who was a classicist and a poet, but taught versification very rigorously. He was quite frightening, so that he would lecture on a form and you would have to practice it during the week and hand it in. And his grades were, the highest grade you could get was NB, which meant not bad. there was NTG, which was not too good. Grades of
doing. It was interesting to talk about that because it reminds me that one of the things that I noticed in the books again and again is an interest in science. And in a way that his grading sounds slightly scientific, doesn't it?
Yes.
Scientific. Two of the things I've noticed reading is an interest in science and particularly that in relation to the body.
Yes.
I've even heard that you've done lots of open university science courses that happens. But yeah.
Yes.
Can you say something about your interest in science?
I'm curious about the world, and I think, you know, all of you who are poets, you will recognise that, I expect, too. I think we are all just curious, and I think it's one important aspect of the world that rewards that curiosity hugely. I love the language of it, too. I think it would be wrong to say the poems are ever about science, because I don't think I would presume to do that, but often the language comes in, and I like to use that. And I like to really try and understand it if I am using it too. That seems important. And the body is everyone knows this too. It's inherently interesting. It is fascinating. It is the kind of stage or theatre for some of the great dramas of our lives. You know, birth, death, everything. Everything happens in here. But it also marks out a kind of boundary between what's inside and the exterior world. So my skin here separates this from that, and I'm just interested in that transaction between outside and inside.
One of your poems, Deft, is very much about that issue, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm also aware of a political sensibility in your work. For instance, poems like "The Swallows Move In" really made me really feel you're a war poet in some ways, and so the St. Brides in Of Mutability.
Yeah.
There seems to be a political conscience. In one interview, you talk about that it's definitely poetry by a feminist, you say, and there's also obviously a concern for climate change and a real concern about war, albeit again, in a particular mode, it's slightly difficult to describe. But just wondering about your political sensibility in the world.
You know, again, it's part of curiosity and being a human being. I just wouldn't leave anything out. I wouldn't even put it in deliberately. I wouldn't say, aha, today I shall write the war poem. again, the poets will know that's not how it works. It's a series of things come together and start to tickle your imagination, and you know that poem is the one that's going to be written. I think, why not? Why leave it out?
Yeah.
Why leave it out?
Yeah. I was very struck by how you brought it in the Swallows poem. It's a very unusual mixture of what seems personal and what seems very political and striking.
I'll read that one later then, but it's again something that interests me about the way we all have to live now, in that we know everything instantly.
Yes.
So you can be, as in the poem, you can be walking across the park in your sort of relatively safe Western life, and at that moment, you know, all sorts of other things are happening, and that's hard to comprehend, isn't it really?
But important to try to comprehend.
Yes.
And of course, I can't really ask more about Of Mutability without asking about, this is delicate question number two, much more delicate, about your diagnosis of breast cancer in 2003. You know, obviously, in interviews with you, there's been a lot of writing about that, and you know, when I also read that I'm not interested in self-revelation, I'm slightly uneasy asking you a rather delicate question. But for instance, you've dedicated the volume to the doctors of Hereford County Hospital. And it feels to me that it is a backdrop of mutability. The first poem read in that light, it does change it, I think. Was that your intention? Would you agree with that even? Is it?
No, I think it's a series of meditations about mortality. And I think to that extent it's a book that would speak to anyone, and I think this is probably everyone in this category, who has experienced that too, whether it's, you know, someone they love or close to them has been ill or died. That's something we all... I can't look around at the age, at our ages, I say, not very tactfully. We kind of know about that, and so the book never mentions breast cancer once, despite everything you've read in the newspaper.
Right, yeah.
All the interviews I did, I went around saying, the book doesn't mention breast cancer once. Mm. It's a series of meditations about mortality. Mm. But it's the story they wanted to tell. It's not the story I wanted them to tell.
Yeah,
it's what they wanted to tell.
In a way, that's interesting in itself.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's been a real education, I must say.
Because all the stories that I've read, all the interviews, really foreground that.
I know.
And have said that's interesting in that context.
Yeah.
And that's very, very striking. So let's talk more about the poems. I've gone through those questions quicker than I was going to. I'm great. Anyway, moving on. I mean, I did feel, I don't know whether, again, you may well not agree, but I did feel there was a change of tone from her book to What Mutability.
Yes.
Difficult to quite say, but again, I was slightly, I'm slightly struck by this, what I would call a sort of serio-comic voice at times. It's not quite right, but something like that, which again reminds me of Bishop. I remember one critic talking about Bishop's compassionate humour, and I thought, God, it was just right, actually. There is this humour that feels very compassionate and sort of wants to connect with tragedy as well, actually.
I think that's true.
And I felt that the tone in that, in your book, touches on that. It's not like Bishop's tone at all, actually, but somehow has something in that. So I don't know if you could say something about that shift of tone, if I'm right in perceiving that. You know.
I think you are right. It's hard to talk about when it's your work, because you probably, again, if you recognise that. But I think I'm pretty sure that you're right. It's hard to put a finger on why. I think it's just the maturing writer as well, you know. And when you finish a book of poems, there's a real sort of mixture of feelings. There's a relief, you know, that's done and you can sort of move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
But then a big kind of fear about what the next thing will be, and often a feeling that the techniques that you have are not up to what you think you might want to do next. You know, you feel you have to make a change, you don't quite know what it is, and you feel kind of itchy almost, you know, so everything, nothing works, and that can go on for quite a long time. But I think between each of my books, I've felt that evolution and having to come to terms with what I now wanted to write. And it's as if the bits of you haven't caught up with each other. And I think that was probably quite a big, so in a big way, between the last two books.
Yes, that's what struck me.
Yeah.
Although now you mention, I think I've seen that reading her book as well. There is changes of tone in that way as well.
Yes.
So, for instance, in her book, there is much more. I think again, the words kind of clumsy, but more overt sort of surrealism. You know, so there's Tom and Jerry in London. There's you become a mad cow, as it were. I mean, as in mad cow disease. there's a monologue by a depressed Superman. There's all these sort of. There's this, you know, again, I'm reminded of people talking about, well, Bishop actually, I think, writing about everyday surrealism. She thought there was something in the everyday, which was much better surrealism than surrealism.
Yeah.
And again, there's something of that in your work. You might say a little bit about those voices in your work.
Yeah, she talks about, you're right, it's a lovely, lovely thing to say, to talk about the surrealism of everyday life.
Yeah, something like that.
Which demands a kind of noticing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Of to make it that way, and she has that eye, that amazing observing eye for it. Surrealism, well, I love the proper surrealists, you know, the real ones. I think, you know, it's, I talked earlier about the pleasure of making things up, and that's what they do par excellence. got a feeling the next book might go even more that way again, or even more than ever before, so you never know. But it has that appeal of connecting things that you wouldn't normally connect. It's the part of, you know, there is a kind of indulgence in poetry writing, and for me that would be it, the pleasure of connecting unexpected things and linking things. The playfulness that's important.
Yes, I feel that in the book. It's almost as if you have a definite dislike, I don't know if it's true, of sort of portentousness, over-earnestness, sort of seriousness in a certain self-conscious kind of way.
I'd be portentous if I could carry it off.
Wouldn't we all? And then, you know, going back to the subject of Bishop, and I mean, I could talk about Bishop too far.
I know, she's so interesting.
There's something about her, you just want to talk about her more and more. You know, so, for instance, Helen Bendler talks about Caruso in England as being a fictionalised autobiography. I mean, it's many other things as well. And I wondered whether that might be also an influence in the sense of a hidden autobiography.
No.
That should have been the last set question.
See, I don't necessarily think that's true of Bishop.
Don't you?
Either.
Oh, really?
Or
she probably would have hated to think it was true.
She probably would have hated to think it was true. And, you know, which is not to say that she doesn't use elements of things that might have happened in her life. But it doesn't make it at all autobiographical. I mean, there are interesting things happen in that poem, like in part that we didn't hear. There's a moment where she's where he meets baby goats and dyes them pink, which is a sort of surreal image, but it's actually from Virgil, from the Eclogues. And by connecting us back to the Eclogues, she's immediately evoking the whole of the idea of pastoral. And then you get the sense of pastoral, we're into prelapsarian consciousness. So the whole thing starts to open up. So, you know, to say it's a fictionalised autobiography in a way is makes it smaller for me than it really is. Every way you look, it's sort of opening things up with all those images, rather than being a little parallel line to things that happened to her. I think probably Wendler meant two things. You may know better than me that one, she had lived in Brazil and moved back to North America. And I can accept maybe some of the descriptions of things that she looks at come from her experience in Brazil. And also that there is a relationship between Friday and Crusoe. So there's a suggestion they actually have a love relationship.
Yes, that's right.
And I think Wendler thinks this is Bishop sort of secretly expressing the idea that she's gay.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, why would she? Or, you know, to suggest that makes you wonder, well, does, you know, there are other gay people in the world, can't we write about them and not be gay or be gay? You know, what, it's not a one-to-one correlation with her, necessarily. I mean, she has heterosexual couples in other poems.
Yes,
so I just think that's, again, a little bit prurient and a little bit making something where you needn't. And I think the idea that they do have this love relationship is very interesting, very intense, and adds to the story that she's creating in the poem.
Yeah,
and so when he dies at the end, you know, when you find out he's been dead for 17 years at the moment the poem is being spoken.
A tragedy.
Yeah.
Carrying on with our mutability, You say that Helen Chadwick, the artist Helen Chadwick, is the presiding spirit of the collection. And as when we first met, I mentioned a little story for everyone, that a few of us met Helen Chadwick. She used, when we set up the Gallery Cafe, which is Buddhist Cafe we set up just down over the road from here, not very far from here. She used to come in every Thursday or Friday, with one of the people she was mentoring, I assume. Usually a very beautiful young lady, perhaps. And they'd spend a lot of the afternoon in the cafe, sometimes the only ones, because we weren't doing very well. I just remember she was just so lovely. I mean, she was so good-natured. She got to know all the staff. And then she died very suddenly after, I think, a flu after parties, as far as I remember. Can you say something about your relationship with Chadwick's work?
I first bumped into it, I think it was 2004, that there was an exhibition of her work in the Barbican. And those of you who don't know her, there's two pieces that she's most famous for. One is a piece called Cacao, which is actually a chocolate fountain. And that was in the exhibition, and you would have to go to appreciate it because of the smell, which is part of it. You can't just look at it. Or, you know, it's the whole experience has to flow over you. But it's a brilliant piece. And the other one is one that's a poem in my book riffs off, really, is a piece called Piss Flowers, in which she and a partner peed in the snow, a male partner, peed in the snow. And so that there's a kind of little witty gender thing going on, because the shapes it made in the snow were different. Then she cast them, and she was an incredible craftswoman. So everything she made was extraordinarily delicately done and beautiful, no flaws in it. It was wonderful. So she cast them in bronze, turned them upside down, and they looked like flowers, and she set them on a kind of green floor. And there were probably about 10 of them, I think. And they're sort of really very, very beautiful. There's a lot of work. Her work is around the body and around oppositional things. In a way, she talked about not being interested in opposition in a way. She liked and rather than, that and this and that. But she was interested in putting together, say, the grotesque and the very delicate, so that you know, your mind starts spinning about it. So there's another famous piece in which she's got some pig's entrails wrapped around some beautiful blonde hair. And again, beautifully set in a kind of frame as well. And it's just, everything's very striking, very interesting, very layered. And she worked with scientists too. I think shortly before she died, she was working on embryos at King's Hospital, I think, in the embryological unit.
I was very struck that you're dedicated to the poet. Anyway, you mentioned her.
Well, she did. I was talking about that kind of moment between books when you know you want to go somewhere and you don't quite know where it is. I think that exhibition came at the right time. It really helped me, in ways it's quite hard to articulate, but it was one of those things. Again, poets who will recognise this, when you read the right book at the right time and it gives you lots of ideas, it opens your mind to things in a different way. I think it was like that.
I mean, in a way, it made me think that you quite often mention art or other artists in your work. There's a poem in Of Mutability, I won't give you the whole title because it's very long, but about Bach's Prelude and Fugue in Minor, or Schoenberg's, anyway. And I was really struck by your poem in her book called On Tour, the Alps, which has all these references back to artists. And then there's your love of music, I'm aware of, and you've worked with a musician. So I wonder if you might talk about how artists have inspired your work.
Yeah, I was very lucky. In my 30s, in the days when I had a proper job, I was an arts administrator at the South Bank. And my job there was working in education, so I was devising programmes with kids in communities, but using the artists who were working at South Bank. So that meant a lot of musicians, but also people from the Hayward Gallery and literature, writers and dancers indeed. So it was like a sort of super education. It was brilliant, because I talked to people, planned things with them, found out lots about them, learned so much from them all. That became like then second nature. So I'd always read a lot, but now I was reading a lot in different media as well.
And yeah, just to sort of draw our discussion to a close, in a way, this is always slightly difficult to work through. What do you think poetry is for, or why do you write? It's a sort of simpler way of putting that, but Auden famously says poetry makes nothing happen. And yet there are political themes in your work, there are gender themes in your work, there is a real desire at times to say something important about the state of the world. There's a desire, it seems to me, to really imagine, radically imagine, recast. At times when I was reading the work, it felt like it is a recasting. Some of the work seems like classic themes recast to me, found a slightly new angle, slightly more oblique angle to talk about great themes that, you know, poets have talked. I'm going off rails here.
Anyway, it's great.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, it's lovely.
That's
lovely.
That's how it felt. You were able. There's one Stargazer, for instance, in Of Mutability, which feels like a classic ode, a praise poem. There's a lovely one about tea, but you don't quite notice that you've gone back to that sort of classic. So I'm just wondering, why do you write? What's poetry for?
Yeah,
you've been doing it a long time.
Yes. I don't know why. Hmm. I really don't know why. But it is what I do. It's so basic now. It's what I do.
Hmm.
That's what I do. So there it is. And what is it for? You all probably know the quote by Holderlin, which is something like, "What is a poet for in a desperate time?"
I don't know the quote.
Yeah, which is an amazing quote, but it hangs there as a question, which he doesn't answer, and I don't think I can answer. And maybe, you know how poems, are one of the great things about them is that they hold questions. They tend not to answer them. And maybe those two very big questions we can just hold and not answer, but think about, because I don't know the answers. But, you know, maybe by writing the poem, you're kind of trying to answer why do I write and what it's for. If you knew, you wouldn't do it, something like that.
Yes. Are you impelled to do that, do you think? Or
Sometimes I have to be chained to my desk.
That's not very impelled.
I'm just, again, poets here will recognise this. It's a typical writer, so sometimes you're impelled. Sometimes it's like hell, and you don't know why you're doing this mad thing again. Other times, not. Other times it's complete opposite. It's just joy. Yes.
Of course. So perhaps let's hold that question. Let's hold the questions, and then the poems themselves will hold that even more. So thank you very much.
Thank you.